Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Europe is creating a ring fence around French and German banks. A government shutdown in the United States is looming once again. Bear flag warning. And our guest today, Barry Ritholtz from Fusion IQ and the famous blog, The Big Picture, and Corey Rosenbloom from Afraid to Trade to talk about this and much more on episode number 231 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast for the end of September 2011. Well, not a lot of great news to talk about, is there? Unfortunately, just what it is. We're not going to hold back on talking about what is in our face right now for the sake of having a silver lining and an upbeat tone and ratings, because we know that we're all about trying to do a couple things. Number one, find out the truth and get to the bottom of things, and also, well, of course, try to make a little bit of money along the way. That's the goal here at the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And this is Andrew Horowitz, and thank you for joining me, and thank you for all your emails. It seems that the recent call on silver and the fact that there was going to be some kind of a significant event did pay off very well last week, where silver and gold, along with markets, of course, really took quite the beating. And that was a combination of the dollar moving higher as well as a liquidity move, where we saw a lot of potential hedge funds and maybe even some sovereignties, some banks, some governments unloading a healthy amount of the precious metals in order to make sure that their balance sheets were going to be, I guess, sufficient if something was to happen very significant, maybe over the weekend or over the next week. And we do think that there is something very significant that's brewing. And you can see by the G20 meeting that occurred this weekend that there is a very much mixed view of what should be done right now. And unfortunately, what that really comes down to is that there is no view. There's no consensus. There's a lot of ideas floating around, like expanding the ESFS and looking at possibly putting a ring fence around the French and German banks. And I'll mention, by the way, that I've said this before and I'll say it again, that I think that it's very much in the cards that all of this is going to come down to the French banks in the end. The high level of sovereign debt that they hold and the toxic debt that they hold is really the biggest problem here. And this is why there was such a great amount of downgrades on French banks when the so-called stress tests were completed. Lots of discussion this week about the stress test being bogus. I'm not sure why they waited so long for that to come out. But we know that was the case, that they were really not so stressful on the banks of Europe, and it was more so of a confidence builder. And unfortunately, when there is, I guess you look at it like a very, very thin layer of ice, which we're going to talk about in a second, and you step on it, and boy, that could be very slippery. As a matter of fact, one of the key economists who puts out a very, very good, almost real-time look at leading indicators is from the ECRI Institute, the Economic Cycle Research Institute, and his name is Lakshman Ashulan, and he came out with some discussion this week, and it was actually taken from an NPR audio cast. And I thought I'd play it for you, and we could talk a little bit about that, what happened this week, as well as Operation Twist, before getting into a few of the other details. Listen to this.
People are getting worried again, and when you look at the forward-looking indicators, they're pointing to continued slowing ahead. And when our growth is already so weak, that means we are skating on very thin ice. The risk of recession in front of us, of a new recession, is quite high. And the jury remains out as to whether or not we're going to go into a recession. We don't have enough information to say it definitively, but I suspect we will have that information by Thanksgiving to know one way or another.
So Thanksgiving is the time period, which makes a lot of sense from an economic standpoint, because what you're going to get is a good pool of information to study on manufacturing, employment, and underlying strength or weakness of the economy. But unfortunately, really, I think that that has to be brought forward a little bit because much of this is going to be dependent on what happens in Europe. And that whole issue really is going to unravel and expand very, very quickly, much quicker than I think that was or is hoped to be expected by Europe. And unfortunately, they don't have any kind of way right now to build confidence. And that is causing an even greater unraveling of the situation. So keep your eyes on France and keep your eyes on Germany. Keep your eyes, of course, on what's going on in Greece. Already there is discussion about creating some kind of a fund to protect the banks, to recapitalize them, because there's going to be approximately 50% haircut on Greek debt. And when you look at the amount of Greek debt, you start thinking about, okay, well, what happens from there? Well, then you have Italy having problems, of course, with their holdings, and the whole thing just topples down upon itself. The fact of the matter is, I'm going to tell you right now, I don't care what anybody says. If you just look at the raw numbers, there is no way that Greece can pay back the obligations that they owe. They don't have enough revenue. They don't have enough growth at all. No growth. They don't have enough backing by their own people to actually go out there, raise taxes, and get that money in, and therefore have any confidence level in the fact they'll be paying back their bondholders, et cetera. So the whole discussion here is how not to make sure that Greece doesn't default, but more so it's about the idea that we want to make sure that we can contain the circumstance as best as possible. So that's, I think, very important. The thing that really was very surprising, I think, to a lot of people last week was this Operation Twist. And the Operation Twist was all about moving the maturities of the balance sheet of the Fed out so they would, as these maturing treasuries would come due, that they bought through the quantitative easing process. And let's just, for the heck of it, let's call it $1.5 trillion or something like that. And when they would come due, they were talking already about reinvesting them. Well, what they did now here is something that was first done and only done back in 1961, where there was a move to actually expand the maturities from a very short term, so keep the short term maturities somewhat stable, moving up a little bit, but flatten the yield curve to give the opportunity for those people who were going to be, paying mortgages and consumer loans, and give the people a lower interest rate. Problem is, just the very notion of it already drove down interest rates pretty strongly. I will tell you, though, that after the Operation Twist, one of the big things that happened was that there was a lot of buzz about how it wasn't enough, only $400 billion in total. And on top of that, there was a lot of surprise about how far they actually went out on the yield curve, pushing down the long bond by close to 5% for the week and bringing it down, not only the 30-year, but the 10-year back down into record territory for yield, which is going to create another whole disaster when it comes to people who are looking for income for their future. Ready? There was an article in the Sun Sentinel this weekend down here in Miami that talked about how people in their senior years are now looking for jobs and scrimping pennies because they're not getting any kind of income on their assets. They just, putting it into a CD or a bank into something that they believe is safe is no longer paying them anything worthwhile. So this Operation Twist that has happened is going to put more pressure on that. And we don't see where the benefit's going to be, and obviously the markets didn't see it either. It's going to cause a flattening of the yield curve, which is worse for banks. Their profitability is based on a steep yield curve. And on top of that, as we wrote about, by the way, if you remember, each day of the month of September, we have been posting our private client-only conversation, the thing that we put out every single day, to our clients of the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy and Horowitz & Company Managed Clients. We actually publish them publicly, so every single day you're getting that. And we talked last week about how Operation Twist will effectively raise the value of the dollar. And we talked about the other factors involved in that. And one of the big issues there is that that really caused a lot of havoc when it comes to the stock markets and commodity markets. Copper fell off a cliff. Silver was just absolutely obliterated. Gold fell like crazy. And that was more so, silver and gold was more so at the end of the week when there was some realization that a liquidity need was going to be required. And then you saw stocks just totally fall apart. I don't know if that was too much of a surprise after the big run-up into options expiration, but I got to tell you something. It is not a pretty sight out there at all right now, with the dollar rising and with Operation Twist being somewhat of a disappointment. So when we're looking at the markets right now, into the end of the month, our plan basically is we do see additional downside coming over the near future. But at the same time, you have to realize it's going to be a massive amount of potential for an asset rebalancing at the end of the quarter, which is only a week away, moving from very good performing bonds into the very poorly performing stocks. So this is something you want to be aware of about, we'll call it Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of next week. We usually leave off the last day so that we don't see the markups as much all the time. But you know, you're going to see this rotation happen, possibly then into the first part of the month. And then from there, unless anything changes dramatically, you're going to see the continuation of the sell-off, in our opinion. Now, the one thing that will stand in the way of any kind of rise, of course, is the European question mark. But that being the case, you have to leave that as the fact that, you know, that's the wild card in all this right now. And that may throw all this out of kilter. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to go to our first guest in a moment and talk about some of the things that are on his mind, Barry Ritholtz from The Big Picture and Ritholtz.com, et cetera. And we're also going to then go to Corey Rosenblum, because I want to talk about this bear flag and some of the patterns and formations that are forming right now in the markets that I think are very much important to be looking at. But I want to mention a couple things beforehand. I mentioned Stocktoberfest is coming. That's right, in October. You send us your stocks, the stocks that you want us to review. Make sure they're reasonably sized stocks, no penny stocks. And we're actually going to put a full summary and detail of our analysis on the website throughout the month. I'll remind you of this throughout the month, but make sure to go over to the podcast summary page for this particular show. And just, there's a little form on there. Just put in your stocks and all the information, and we'll be happy to work on that. Something that I really need your help with is the podcast awards. The 7th annual podcast awards are here, and you have to nominate your favorite podcast. So there is a link there, and there's all sorts of information on the website at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Please go and nominate. You only have a couple of days to do this, and I'm a little bit late with this, but go over there, and then you're going to vote eventually if we actually make the nominations. So put us in for the People's Choice and the Business, etc. On another point I want to mention also is that we have coming up Guy Adami, Larry Williams, Frank Curzio in the next few podcasts. So lots happening there, and I think that's pretty good. So let's get to Barry Ritholtz, and then what we're going to do is we're going to segue over into a couple of minutes of another section that I want to talk about how we're managing our portfolio and what we have in our portfolio now. And then we're going to talk about the latest formations that we need to be aware of from a technical standpoint with Corey Rosenblum. With us now is Barry Ritholtz from Fusion IQ and from the author of Bailout Nation. You may know him from his blog, formerly called The Big Picture. Still called The Big Picture. He writes for probably every newspaper, and you've seen him on every TV show. And Barry, I'm wondering when you're actually going to be on an episode of either The Family Guy or The Simpsons at this point.
That's a good question.
They haven't asked you yet, huh?
We're just negotiating the syndication rights. That's all that's holding us back. By the way, I don't know if you've noticed, I've been doing a lot less television the past couple of quarters.
Really? Yeah.
Some of it is because I was unwilling to do certain things that they asked, and some of it is just, you may not have noticed this, but it's got a little busy in the market.
Yeah.
And television is enormously time-consuming.
Well, you got to be on the spot. You got to be there, or at least you got to get to a satellite, and then you got to deal with, and then what do you get? You get a minute and a half to try to prove a point that you're saying, and then the fleeting moment that somebody may or may not see you is pretty rough.
Well, you can embed it. The nice part about it is that what used to be lost to the ether, you can capture and embed onto the website, so you do get to keep a digital version of it. I prefer the longer, more in-depth discussions as opposed to, you know, give me a stock for the next 15 seconds. You know, that sort of debate, I don't think it helps anybody, certainly not the viewer. And it, you know, there's this obsessive focusing on the flavor of the moment, the stock of the minute. You know, all the academic literature, all of the studies have pretty much made it clear your asset allocation model is going to matter much more than this particular stock. Or look, bottom line, you could have been the world's greatest stock picker in 08 if you were fully invested in the long. No matter what you bought, you got shellacked. And conversely, if you allocated to the right asset classes in 2009, and that being equities, bonds, and commodities, it doesn't matter if you're a terrible stock picker. Just about everything went up, some stuff up more than others, but it was hard not to make money in that environment.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you a couple of things. That's an interesting point. The word on the street now that you hear, and when looking at TV and talking and listening to most of the pundits, is that, you know, hey, S&P is going to have this earnings, the P/E ratio is going to be that, and you multiply it out, and everything is good. And I think there's some players out there that just knocked their numbers down to about 1420 from 1450 end of year. Goldman and a few, that was just, I mean, a big boy, you know. And but they've knocked them down, and obviously they're running out of time is the problem. It has nothing to do with what they, you know, their research at this point, it seems. Why is it that there's this obsessive need to constantly be, I don't want to say bullish, but kind of overly confident in all of these numbers in the face of the Japan situation, the European situation, the Middle East? None of that seemed to matter in any of their models.
What? How much time do we have? I can give you about 3 weeks. 3 weeks to answer this. But let me give you the short version, and I'll get increasingly more granular as we dig in. I'm fond of saying monkeys love a narrative, and so by monkeys I mean us slightly cleverer pants wearing primates. And by narrative, nobody wants to look at the history, the data, the actual hard numbers. Instead, everybody wants to hear a story. And look, for most of human history, information was passed along through parables, through storytelling. A lot of the errors that we make as investors trace back to the fact that, 100,000 years ago, we were sitting around a campfire eating freshly slaughtered whatever creature we happened to capture and telling stories, and that's how we learn, that's how we pass along, I don't want to say data, but information. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is analysts as a whole are not particularly good at A, forecasting in general, and B, they're especially terrible at forecasting as we enter a major turn in either the broad economy or the equity markets, or often both. So Jim Bianco did an interesting study that I wrote about a few weeks ago, and he looked at both the top-down strategists and the bottom-up analysts. They used to actually be a distinction between the two in terms of their success rate, but they got worse and worse over time together, and so their forecasts sort of converged. Before 2000, heading into any sort of contraction, recession, whatever you want to call it, analysts and strategists both overestimated earnings by about 15%. One of the two was a little better, but it was not a huge difference. In the 2001 recession, the overestimation of earnings for the S&P 500 was about 25%. In other words, as the recession took hold and as earnings plummeted, the analyst community was looking for 15% too high a number than what they actually got. And then once we got into the 2007-08-09 credit crisis, the analyst community overestimated earnings going into that turn by 40%. So a lot of this comes back to, as a group, as a whole, analysts tend to always be too bullish. That's the inherent bias built in to Wall Street. I think the way the sell-side business model has morphed over the past few decades, they are much less about giving advice to investors and much more about the underwriting, investment, banking process, IPO, syndication process than they are about own this because it's good, own that because it's bad. And so you end up with just a very different focus. And the last thing is simply tracking error. Us humans are pretty bad about guessing what the future is going to look like. Right. And the caveat to that is, most of these guys aren't that good at looking out the window and telling you, you know, if it's sunny or rainy. Economists especially are horrific at evaluating what's going on today. So how the hell can we expect them to tell us what 12 months from now is going to look like if they don't really understand what's happening at this moment?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I find really fascinating is when you take what you just said and you add it to the fact, as human beings, we want to oftentimes prove ourselves right when maybe the right answer should be proving ourselves wrong, or looking for that is going to prove us wrong. So what we do is we're naturally in a position that we gravitate towards the information that we want to see. So if we want to see a bullish report on a stock, we will take and look at those and say, okay, that's good, and we'll discount the others. It's like, you know, when my grandmother would go to the doctor, and the doctor would say, you know, I think you need surgery. She says, I'm going to get a second opinion. She goes to the next doctor and says, you know, what, you need surgery. Four doctors say she needs surgery. She goes to the fifth doctor and says, he says, no, you don't need surgery. She says, I knew it. You know,
classic confirmation bias. And this is fairly typical of how humans behave. Look, the data. So again, I'm going to step back a little bit. So the past couple of years, I've been going around the country giving speeches, and I have three different speeches I give. One is all about in support of Bailout Nation. It was all about here's how the collapse happened, here's why, hey, maybe here's what we can do about it. If I'm speaking to a group of hedge funds, mutual fund managers, institutional investors, it's a deep dive into market histories, long-term secular cycles, what valuation means, and really try and give them some insight that they may not see in their day-to-day stuff. And the third speech is all about is what you're when you're speaking to mom and pop and traditional investors. And I start every one of those speeches the exact same way, which is here's the single best advice you're ever going to get, and all of you will ignore, which is dollar cost average into a broad basket of indexes. And you know, if you want to put an overlay of risk management on top of it, I suggest a 10-month moving average. But none of you will do that, and history bears me out. Nobody does that. I started working on a new speech just because I'm bored of those three, and it's called This Is Your Brain on Stocks, which is a play on This Is Your Brain, This Is Your Brain on Drugs. And I've spent a good part of my career looking at the various behavioral economic issues and now more and more some of the neuroeconomic factors that are going on. And the one that always comes up time and again is the selective perception and the selective retention and the bias that's just so built into our wetware. We really aren't very good as a species at understanding risk, allocating capital, recognizing the combination of risk versus reward, thinking that if you do the same thing over and over again, you're going to get a different outcome. There's just a laundry list of things, and it's just astonishing to see these errors over and over and over again. People just, you know, they don't want to learn from the mistakes of the rest of the species.
Yeah, and the other thing that's happening also, I think you would agree that markets over time change. And one of the things that we're seeing right now is the realization of some of the emotional overlays that are involved in picking stocks and the greed-fear combination is being replaced by, machinery, and that could outsmart you, outwit you, and they don't cry at the end of the day if they make a mistake.
There's some of that. To me, the key takeaway is the machinery may change, the market may change, but human nature is unchanging, never behaves differently. The one thing we need to learn is that we seem to learn nothing about history, at least in finance. That just seems to be the general mistake everybody makes. And so I'm not sure if it's all that different. I've heard all sorts of crazy statistics as to what percentage of actual trading is silicon as opposed to us carbon-based units.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers like 70% have been blown way out of proportion. But whatever it is, it's a factor. But into that factor comes human fear and greed. And I frequently say what most people think of as greed is really fear. You know, in late 99, that's greed. Oh, my God, the market's doubling. I got to get in. Look at these dot-coms. Look at Yahoo at 250. Look at EMC. That's really greed. What most people look at during a market move as greed is really fear. Fear of missing the rally. Fear of if I underperform, what's this going to do to my career?
Mm-hmm.
Fear of losing clients. Fear of losing income. Fear of losing your job. That is what, at least on a professional basis, what people think of as greed isn't exactly greed. It's fear. In fact, what was last week or 2 weeks ago, the biggest one-week spike we've seen in equity prices in 2 years or 3 years.
Yep.
That's not a normal bull market reaction.
Oh, no. That's classic bear market.
Classic bear market. But think about what's involved in to cause that sort of spike. That is the train's leaving the station. Oh, my God, I got to get on board.
Yeah.
And a week later, you're 10% lower.
Yeah.
That is really much more fear than pure greed.
Right. Now, I know that we have a limited time, so I want to mention a couple of things. First of all, you have a conference coming up called the Big Picture Conference, and information about that is available. And you're going to have a lot of speakers, and this new speech, I guess, are you unveiling it there?
I've done a couple of tests of it. I have a smaller audience up in the Contrary Opinion Forum, which is something that's been going on for 40 years. So before the speech, I'll give them a version of it. And in Vancouver this year, I gave a real test run about it. It's kind of a fun thing. I'll do a short version, a 30-minute version of it at the conference. If you look at the list of people who are showing up, I'm really jazzed. We have Jim Bianco, is one of my favorite analysts. He's going to talk about correlation during crises, why it happens, what it means. Speaking of high-frequency trading, speaking of silicon, the guys from Themis Trading, Joe Saluzzi and Sal Arnock, have done all this research on what HFT is actually doing to the capital structures of the market. We had gone to dinner a couple of weeks ago, a few of us, about six, eight of us, and the two of them went off on the subject, and it was just one of the most astonishing conversations I ever heard. Paul Brodsky is a guy who has just been killing it when it comes to investing in currencies, commodities, and gold. Just put up a fantastic track record. He's going to talk about where the upside is, what the risks are. He's just a really sharp guy. We have a couple of really good panels. We have one on how the new breed of entrepreneurs build their brands. There's a little bit of venture capital and startup discussion, and there's also the impact of new media on investing, and it's people like Kelly Evans from the Wall Street Journal, Joe Wiesenthal from Business Insider, Todd Harrison from Minionville, and Daniel Gross from Yahoo Finance, and really that's just the tip of the iceberg.
I can't be there to speak about how the whole podcasting thing. I know you want to be up there and all that, but you know.
I know. Maybe you'll make the next one. By the way, it's funny because the last time we did a conference, we did it right in the middle of the collapse.
Oh, really?
You know, right in 2009. And, you know, you couldn't give tickets away. People were hiding under the desk.
Right.
This group, oh, did I leave out Doug Kass?
Doug Kass.
Always does fascinating conversation.
He's such an eloquent use of words.
You know, the one comment that I got over and over again about the last conference we did, so someone asked Doug a question about, and obviously this is the middle of the collapse of AIG and Bank of America and Lehman, and he tells a whole long story about he's essentially a bottoms-up balance sheet guy and goes into all these details and how he began. And what I love about Doug is nothing is ever a yes or no answer. It's always a parable. So after this whole song and dance about I'm a bottoms-up balance sheet guy, and I don't follow technicals, all I understand is, you know, cash, discounted cash flow and earnings, the very next question is, what do you think about gold? And instead of saying, hey, didn't you hear the last question, Doug lays out, and I won't tell the story because it's too long, but he lays out this delightful arc of a story that ends with everybody but his mentor going bust and his mentor cashing out it was either the CBO or the CBOT after it went public, $1 billion+. And the answer was, hey, Dougie, you know, I made $1 billion. I just stuck to my knitting. So to answer your question about gold, I have no idea. but you have to appreciate the way he crafts this arc. It's very Socratic, and it's very much an Aesop's fable type of parable. So instead of having him give a speech, what we decided to do is just set up a whole bunch of questions we're going to take from the online audience beforehand, pick the best, and just sort of you know, throw these hanging curveballs for Doug to hit over the left field fence.
Great. You know, I want to just to mention to you, I'm going to send you a piece that I got yesterday on a... It was basically about the twist. I don't know if you read the piece about how I was against the twist and where I thought this whole thing was going to break down. So after the fact, somebody sent me something which I thought was just absolutely fascinating. It was a 2004 piece about how the twist that was last done in 1961 had failed. And kind of documenting at least what they could find, because it was relatively small. I think it was $8 billion that they did. Do you know who one of the authors of that was?
Ben Bernanke.
Correct.
Yeah, not a surprise. He is a student of history, and some of the comments that we've been putting out both yesterday and today pretty much have said, look, in a post-credit crisis environment where the consumer is deleveraging, there's only so far that monetary policy will take you, mm-hmm. and you essentially have two options. You could wait a decade and let the cleansing functions of the economy, of a recession, of a market crash, you know, realign capital to where it should be. That politicians never want to do this. That is certainly one credible option. The other option requires a pretty substantial fiscal response.
Mm-hmm.
And so since we don't seem to be getting any sort of fiscal response, at least not in the U.S., you have to look at where this could potentially go and what might otherwise be. By the way, my job isn't to tell the Fed what to do and what not to do. It's to see what they do, interpret it, and advise clients how to position themselves.
Right, exactly.
But the key takeaway to me with this that I'm so astonished that everybody seems to be missing, you know, we just had this nice boom from 2003 to 2007.
Mm-hmm.
During an economic expansion, that's when smart presidents like Reagan, like Clinton, actually try and rein in some rate of growth on spending and raise taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those guys had great economies, great markets, and the stunner that people forget is, as the expansion continued, they wanted to, A, although, you know, we could say Reagan raised the deficit, but had he given in to Congress, it would have been much, much worse. So what you should do is you reduce government spending, or certainly the rate of growth of government spending, and you increase taxes, which is what he did for 7 of his 8 years. Clinton similarly cut some spending, or the rate of spending, increased taxes. That makes sense. What happened the previous two, almost three terms, during that 2003-2007 expansion, we did the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
We cut taxes during expansion, making the deficit worse, and we increased spending, making the deficit worse. The only time I want the government doing that is when the economy is contracting and when the private sector steps away, so they fill in. I think all the criticism we've seen of Keynes, people are looking at it backwards. Keynes would say, no, during this expansion, you raise taxes and cut government spending and let the private sector do its thing. Now that the private sector has essentially gone into a deep retrenching and are sitting on their hands, now's the time you should be cutting taxes and raising spending,
mm-hmm.
instead of talking about raising taxes and cutting spending.
Yeah, no,
the Austrians have it just exactly 180 degrees backwards.
My favorite part of this piece that I know, is the discussion of the tool, one of the very key tools that the Fed has, which is the communication tool, which in some circles is called rhetoric and BS and just a carrot.
Jawboning,
yeah.
Sure.
But it is a tool that they functionally use, and it outlines some of the things they use inside of their statements to adjust thinking, and they know the power of the psychological power this has. In particular, this is all about a zero interest rate environment. This paper, I'll send it over to you. I thought it was fascinating.
Definitely send it. Although to me, you know, the Fed communicates in my book by saying, "Here's where rates are," and if they have to spend a lot of time jawboning, it pretty much is telling you that their basic monetary policy is failing, and now they have to engage in extraordinary policy. This
right.
We want to be more communicative. Hey, that worked before Jackson Hole and QE2, but with no QE3, the jawboning just, you know, is meaningless.
Yeah, I hear you. So again, tell us when the Big Picture Conference is coming up.
Big Picture Conference is in New York City. It's at the New York Athletic Club, October 11th. If you go to either the Big Picture site at ritholtz.com or just search for Big Picture Conference, and you'll find a number of sign-ups. The conference is $8.95. If you sign up before October, you get the discounted version, which is substantially lower than that. And it's relatively modest-sized room. It's only 300 or so people. It's not one of these 2,000-person conferences. Take a look at the lineup. It's terrific. We're still working on some last-minute surprise guests, and I think anyone who goes is going to come away with a really, really solid day of education and insight and, you know, real eye-opener.
All right, great. We'll put that on the site. As a matter of fact, I'll take you have a graphic there. I'll transfer that over to our site as well and give you a little bit of, you know, kind of put that there for people. So just go over to the disciplinedinvestor.com, the show notes for this show, and we'll put links there also. But you just go yourself right over to can you get your site by just typing in the big picture? You can, right?
The big picture, you'll pull up like four different big pictures.
Why don't you just forward the old site right to the new one?
Oh, well, the old site does forward it. The problem is that there's my big picture. There's the Boston.com big picture that showed up a few years after mine. You'll pull up the big picture at IMDb. There's a whole bunch of related
But you're not going to pull up the big picture over at Seeking Alpha, are you?
I decided some time ago.
I don't work with them either.
I was not happy with what they were doing with my work, and so we
pulled also.
All agreed to move on.
I agree.
Look, I'm constantly telling people your stuff has to have value, and if someone wants to use, you know, it has to be mutually productive, and if it's not mutually productive, what you going to do?
I hear Barry Ritholtz from Ritholtz.com, The Big Picture, the author of Bailout Nation, hopefully soon to be a HBO special. I was so bummed. I was waiting for Andrew Sorkin to get Ross Sorkin. Sorry to get you know, he got so many nominations at the
Emmys. Can I tell you? I really enjoyed the movie. I didn't read the book, but I really enjoyed the movie. I thought they did a real nice job with it. You know, my problem with it is the same problem I have with all of these quasi-fictionalized, you know, you're getting people's recollections of what they claim they were feeling. I think the reality is far uglier than Paulson's recommendation of his noble thoughts when he was on his knees praying and then throwing up in the waste paper basket. And then I get the sense as I was watching this, and truth be told, I skimmed much of the book. I get the sense that the writing team went to various people for quotes, and when someone refused, they said, it's no big deal. We'll just go with Jamie Dimon's version. And guys, the other person says, hey, wait a second.
Right.
You know, he's not really, you know what I mean? I suspect that was the technique, and it was probably fairly effective.
Well, I'm glad the movie came out, because I had a name for the book when it came out, and when I got a copy of it, I renamed it Too Big to Read.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
It was enormous. I said, what is that? It's like an encyclopedia.
I have to give Andrew credit. Andrew just did a tremendous amount of research. A lot of work went into that. I like stuff, again, that's less. If I'm going to read a narrative, I love guys like, you know, Michael Lewis, who is, you know, such a great storyteller, as opposed to something like this. I'd rather have someone read it, contextualize it, put all the details into a bigger format, as opposed to everybody's recollection.
Right.
You got a lot of those out of one of the political writers in D.C. at the Washington Post who broke Watergate.
Right.
All of his subsequent books sort of were that fly on the wall in the room.
Right.
And you're relying on people to be, you know, what was his name?
I don't know.
He broke the Watergate story. He did a book on the Supreme Court. He did a book Bush at War. And it's everybody tells you what they were thinking.
Right.
And it's, you know, it wildly diverges from reality.
Yeah, but the great thing about Andrew is he did this all before he turned to age 15. You know what I'm saying?
He's early 30s. He's married. He has a couple of kids.
Yeah, he
just had twins.
Yeah.
What's more impressive is he did it without sleeping.
We'll close with this, but do you know that a week and a half before he took the anchor job on CNBC,
right?
He was on my show. And I said to him, Andrew, let me ask you a question. It seems like you're being groomed to get a permanent morning anchor position on CNBC. That's what it seems like to me. No, denial across the board. Okay, no, and I was just there was nothing I knew. But
that's standard negotiating. Yeah. If you're in the middle of your agent is talking to their lawyers and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
I had lunch with him about the same time, and maybe it was 2 weeks before, and the conversation, which I can't really disclose, wasn't all that far off from your conversation
in terms of,
hey, where are you going? What are you doing with this? And how do you feel about, you know, I would like to see him keep the rest of the Squawk Box group a little more honest. There's just far too many isms and far too much ideology. My only ism is pragmatism, and I find that I'm frequently flicking the show off in the morning because I don't really care what this guy or that guy's politics are.
Well, but the thing is,
I wake up, what's the data, what's coming out, give me some insight. What happened in Japan? What happened in Europe? Give me some insight. And instead, someone else described it as, the view for stocks. But it's not. It's when you have a bunch of women sitting around talking about whatever, there's no urgency because the market isn't about to open. In the morning, just give me the bullet points, give me the highlights, and just shut up with this nonsense. It's, hey, but maybe that's why I'm not on a show.
I will tell you this. I will tell you this, and then I know we got to go. But, Steve Leisman, he's grown into this incredible silver lining cheerleader looking for any piece of data that disputes the negativity. And that, not all the time, but many times, always looking for that little tidbit. And I don't understand what the point of that is from a news organization.
That's easy. The Fed has, over the years, developed conduits to the markets through the media. Right now at the Wall Street Journal, it's John Hilsenrath. A few years ago, it used to be, I'm drawing a blank on his name, Asian reporter who ended up going to The Economist.
He went to The Economist. I've had on the show a few times.
Savvy guy.
I
love John Hilsenrath's work.
Jonathan somebody.
And he, he's now become the Fed guy. And when it comes to Leisman, he's the Fed's television, liaison. That's not a formally his name and business card, but that's exactly what is how he's been used. And I think they're looking for something out of people. It's not quite an explicit quid pro quo. They found him for a specific reason, and I don't think it's uncorrelated. Although to some degree, that's been sort of his personality. In fact, most of television, Nouriel Roubini doesn't have a show for an obvious reason.
Neither does Charlie Gasparino anymore. Although he's over at Fox.
Well, he went over to Fox.
Well, because Fox can handle any kind of anything that's mishandleable. Or unhandleable,
I loved when Charlie was a Wall Street Journal reporter, and his book, Blood on the Street, is just, sharp elbows, and when he was an investigative reporter, he was killer. I think as he got more and more away from that and more into commentary, a lot of his what he did really well, he moved away from. And when he was on CNBC, right during the crisis, he became Dick Fuld's mouthpiece to the street and conduit to everybody. And what ended up happening is, that sort of access journalism, you become an apologist for those guys. I was thrilled to death. Charlie did a huge fortune for me, a huge, huge favor. I posted this on the blog, when we were short Lehman and other guys who more famously were short Lehman, like Einhorn, we were writing critical things. Gasparino was on CNBC and said, hey, who the hell are you going to believe? You're going to believe shorts like Einhorn and Ritholtz, or you're going to believe Dick Fuld? Dick Fuld is, he's the man.
Right.
And, Gasparino has earned my everlasting gratitude for that moment of CNBC history because, hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate that.
I hear you.
Who should you have believed? And it turned out not to be Dick Fuld or any of his media representatives.
I hear you. Barry Ritholtz, The Big Picture, Ritholtz.com, Bailout Nation, available in all bookstores around town, and Fusion IQ, great, I guess we can call it a great quantitative and technical and fundamental type of process. I appreciate it, and everybody can go check it out with all those great guests over at the Big Picture Conference coming up soon. Thanks, Barry.
Thank you.
All right, buddy, I'll see you. Bye-bye.
All right, that was great.
I love talking with Barry. Great guy. very, very smart and has a great network of people that he works with and knows in that can gather information and help him with, you know, deciphering what's going on, because a lot of deciphering to be done, I'll tell you that much. Before we get to Corey, I wanted to mention that we have over at here, we've done a few things. We've really scaled back over the last several months on our equity exposure. I mean, last year we really, really pulled back on European exposure, because you know that I am just absolutely flabbergasted about what's going on there and have been for some time. So this isn't a new thesis. I don't know what's going to fix it. I don't know what's going to come out of this, but I know it's not going to be pretty. So what we did was we really scaled back on that. We actually took some money off the table in bonds. We have a lot of money in cash over the last several months in our Horowitz & Company Global Allocations, which is more of our longer-term, more traditional style of investing. And then in the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, right now, as of today, we have absolutely no stocks as of last week, because we got all of our signals. They kind of all went to zero. And we've seen that from time to time, of course, where we're in a strong downtrend. And you don't want to really be investing as in core positions at that point until you see any kind of a signal that there is some relief happening in markets. And we have closed out some of the options we had last week on silver and on the financial sector, which worked out. And we also now have a small short, actually a couple of shorts on the small cap area, whether, you know, the Russell 2000 through an ETF. We have a 10% core holding now of a single time ETF on the small cap. That's what we do during these kind of downtrends until we see it turn a bit, and we'll get a signal for that. And then on top of that, we also have a trading position short the small caps right now. That's pretty much it. And we will actually do some intraday trading, short-term overnight trading, swing trading in this kind of environment. But there's no way that I think you should really be thinking about getting into, oh, I'm going to buy the bottom. You never know where the bottom is going to be. You never know where the top is going to be. But following the basic trend and some real good core disciplines is what you need to be doing right now. Hope and luck and maybes don't cut it. Okay, they just absolutely do not cut it. You need to have a discipline that you say, okay, you know what? I own this stock. I like this stock. And you know what? It's just not performing right now. I own Ford. I think it's a great company. Mullally did such a great job at coming through all this without using any public debt and any bailouts from the government. And wow, just, did you see the stock lately? Or how about, man, Bank of America is undervalued. Well, okay, really? How do you know? Undervalued compared to what? Just because you hear on TV that everybody's saying, oh, Bank of America is a great position to own. I mean, man, it's a great position to own. It seems all the way from 30 to 20 to 10, now to 6. That's not my kind of investment. I don't know about yours. Unless you're looking for tax deductions, I guess. So when you're looking at this environment right now with all the different headwinds that you have, but more so, you know, that's one thing. But more so when you look at the actual technicals, because that's what takes over right now. If you remember, we talked with John Markman a few weeks back, and his commentary was, listen, if we go into a recession, you're going to have about a 30, 40% correction from here from earnings. Well, we don't know if we're there yet, although I will tell you our opinion is, yes, we are in a recession right now. We have just started the recession. The numbers on manufacturing, the numbers on confidence, the unemployment numbers are recessionary levels. So are we going to hit an actual technical level of negative GDP? Well, it's very possible and probable. It's going to be this quarter, next quarter? Well, we'll have to see. But right now, we're so close, you can almost taste it. If you look at the last revisions that we've seen and the forward projections and the doubt by the Fed, and then that you have to include all the different things that are happening in the economy as well when you look at not only U.S., but the globe. So I just want to mention that we are in a negative to neutral territory in terms of how we view being invested right now. And I think that you need to be very, very careful, because I do not like what I'm seeing here. So don't try to be a hero in this kind of environment by any means, because it will just get you burned. Now, Corey Rosenblum from Afraid to Trade, and a couple of things I want to mention before I talk to Corey, but, you know, Corey is a great technical analyst, has a great book out, his site is wonderful, we'll talk about that in a second, but one of the things that I do oftentimes is we have these meetings and discussions about, you know, look at this pattern, what do you think, is it kind of shaky, is it real, And not all patterns, I think Cora will agree, but not all patterns actually play out. But one of the things that we've both seen is this bear flag pattern that is playing out right now in the S&P 500. So I thought what we'd do is, number one, talk about what is this pattern, and also, you know, what is the likelihood? So I thought no better to bring on than Corey Rosenblum. Corey, how are you, buddy?
Doing great, Andrew. How are you doing?
I am great, thanks. Now, so let's talk a little bit about what's been going on. It's been a pretty sloppy market action. I think you could agree with that.
Absolutely, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's the polite way of saying it. So, we wrote a piece that we're going to put on the website. We'll link it. It's going to be available on Monday, called "The Bear Pattern," and it's confirmed textbook in a way. Tell us a little bit about flag patterns, and in particular, because they're reverse of each other. There's a bull and a bear. Tell us how you arrive at a bear pattern, the probability of it confirming and fulfilling its targets, and kind of a little bit more about where we are now in that.
Sure. A bear flag really was the first, and they've been throughout the history of technical charting since Dow, really, but the ones that brought it to the public attention was Edwards and McGee, and they wrote technical analysis of stock trends. And so they gave the parameters. And there's three components to a classical or typical bear or bull flag. We're speaking in terms of bear flags, so I'll just use those terminologies. The initial phase is the impulse. That's a large move, range expansion, trend move, and it's a continuation move that it looks like almost like a pull. They call it the pull, actually. So the first phase is an impulse or pull, which leads to the second phase, which is a consolidation. And a bear flag takes the form of a rising wedge, a rising parallel trend channel. So that usually takes the form of an ABC or a choppy overlapping pattern, and we've seen that just recently in the S&P. That's the flag component. And the third component is where the people trade. It's actually, you really can't trade an impulse, you can't trade the flag component. Traders would look to trade the actual ejection from the flag into the measure move. And that's going to be the third phase, is that measure move or the projection. And there's two ways to get that classical target. The first would be to take the initial impulse. In this case, in the S&P, it's about 220 points. And the first, and this is the way I prefer to do it, is to subtract that level from the top when you believe the flag is complete, and that's about 1,230 in the S&P, 1,220 at that level. So what that gives us is that projection is about 978, 980 in the S&P 500. The second way, or the alternate way, which is the way Edwards and McGee popularized it, is to take the actual bottom of the flag and project from there. So make the measure move off the lows, and that's off of the around about 1150 or so. So that makes an even lower target to about 950. So that's your classical flag.
Yeah, so we could talk about maybe the average of the two to give us, we'll call it, 980, 970, something like that.
Yeah, that's fair. I like to look in terms of zones. So there's actually a lot of confluence just above that. I would say it just for easier reference, 1,000, but correct. The initial flag would be about 980.
So we're talking about let's call it a 10% correction from here, right? Or so, maybe 12?
Yeah, in terms of percentages, I like to look in terms of point values. Mm-hmm. It makes more sense to me, but right, if taking the average, it's about 10, 12% looking for a downside move. One thing to be clear about is if you're looking at the way I project them, some of the move has already occurred.
Mm-hmm.
We're taking the 12-20, just about half of the move, and we've fallen, goodness, after the Fed announcement on a Wednesday, the market fell about 100 points mm-hmm. in the next couple of sessions. So we're already halfway to the completion of our target under that metric. That's why I prefer that. It's a little bit more conservative, but I tend to find better results doing that.
So here's the interesting point, or the interesting question, I think. When you look at this bear flag, and there are all sorts of reasons why a pattern develops and it actually completes or, you know, could overshoot, undershoot, et cetera. And patterns are by no means, I think you agree, absolute. You know, there's a lot of things that can happen.
Absolutely.
But the whole point of you looking at a pattern is because when you look at a pattern, it's the past patterns. What have they done? How historically accurate have they been? And what is it all about? So what's the mentality? Nobody's just looking at this pattern and saying, oh, like we're doing right now, bear flag, sell. I mean, what is the message from this pattern?
Sure. A lot of patterns I look at, head and shoulders, flags, rectangles, triangles, whatever, the classic patterns, they're not magic by any means. Of course not. What they do is play off of price dynamics, auction profile, market profile, whatever the terminology you wish to use. It just comes down to supply and demand. And so that initial impulse is sort of a shock move. It's an unexpected in this case, a breakdown. At the highs of 1350, we had a major support level at 1260 in the S&P, and that broke. So when that happened, it caused a feedback loop. And a feedback loop is simply buyers initially are liquidating. They're either liquidating, which is selling their positions, or they are putting on short sell positions to hedge or otherwise making a defensive maneuver. That joins with short sellers, bears, those think the market is going to go lower, or for fundamental reasons, technical reasons, they wish to be short the market. And so that's a combination of bulls selling to liquidate, and then of short sellers, also short selling to initiate new or existing positions. That's what the logic in terms of price dynamics of the first phase of the flag, the, one would say, violent impulse. The second phase is the flag, which is a retracement. Nothing at any point in time goes straight up or straight down. So usually it's a correction. Short sellers, after, what was it, a 200-point move, that's a phenomenal move in the S&P, during the mini-crash or mini-collapse into June, July, especially August is when the most of it happened. Anyway, they take their positions off, so they're actually taking a profit. That is a bullish maneuver that causes the market to rise. When short sellers remove their hedges or remove their short positions, it's a bullish exit. Also, we call them bottom feeders or bottom fishers or people that want to call the bottom in the market. There was a major, major confluence at 1100 in the S&P.
Mm-hmm.
And so the market just simply, it's a buy signal. The buyers responded and the market rose. That's what creates the actual flag, is an impulse or a counter movement up in price. Well, the move is either, that's your first two phases of the flag formation. The market either will rally, continue higher, break resistance, come back above its initial 1250 level. That did not happen. And, of course, we have we're talking about the flag at this point. We would not be talking about a flag had the opposite effect happened. So the second phase of a bear, or the actual final phase of a flag, is a continuation impulse down. Flags are continuation moves. They are pro-trending moves, typically. And so once the profit takers or the short sellers have removed their positions and with profits off of the lows and buyers have entered the market, sellers tend to take over the supply-demand balance. And we had an enormous headwind that happened recently with the Federal Reserve, Operation Twist, and the market's disappointing
mm-hmm.
reaction to that. So that
right.
changed a lot of psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And so now that's the initial impulse going down. So what happens with patterns sometimes that they get public attention is it becomes self-fulfilling prophecies. And that may be happening now, especially separate from the flag. It's just a major support level, Fibonacci confluence, moving averages on higher time frames, prior price levels at 1100. And if that level falls, it's just very simple from a chart standpoint. We would expect a second powerful feedback loop to develop. Same thing that happened at 1250. Which is the short sellers would be taking the initial market down, sellers would be liquidating, so those buyers that try to buy off the bottom would be taking their stop losses or otherwise putting on hedges. Long story short, that would be the impulse or the psychological push, one would say, to create this third phase of the flag, which is a violent sell maneuver, that looks similar to the initial impulse that took us down.
Now, let me ask you something. Tell me if this makes sense. Let's talk about this from a different angle for 1 second. It's the same discussion, but let's talk it from a behavioral finance angle. So the first leg down of the flag is a panic due to an unforeseen circumstance or a realization that something is really occurring that maybe people have been really nervous about for some time. And what happens then is that, yes, some technical breakpoints happen, and stock markets move lower, and people say, you know what, I am not willing to take a loss beyond this point, which then turns into a seller's, frenzy. And then from there, what happens is there's a point, whether it's a stock market stops, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or weekend, there's some news item, or at least there's some people that said, you know what, okay, I'm not selling right now, it's too low. What happens there is a slowdown of the supply available of sellers on the market. And then there we get that kind of layoff. People say, okay, let's see what happens from here. And then people start nibbling in and buying in. When they buy in, they get all excited, they're going to move forward. But then all of a sudden, they have a much lower threshold of where they're going to sell out because they say, you know what, I'll buy, but I'm not going to lose much money on this. If it starts going up, I'm great, I'll buy into it. But if it starts moving down, I'm going to get out really quickly. And that's when you break that level of where that bottom was from the original bottom of the pole, where you get that massive move of selling, because not only are you getting the selling that goes on under normal circumstances, but you got all those people bailing out of positions they just entered into with a very, very low tolerance for risk on the downside. Same pattern.
That's absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And that's exactly it. That's the second component, is that the they're thinking this is a support level. This is all it's going to have. The market is forming a bottom. And on the higher time frames, until recently, the market was in an uptrend, and the buy the pullback mentality was king. That was working quite well. Well, it's just a simple repeat of behavior. Well, I bought multiple pullbacks recently. They worked out. But what happens if this one does not?
Right.
Correct. They'll take their stops at a much quicker rate, which could actually make the down move even worse.
Right. So now we put a whole article up, and a lot of Corey's charts as well as mine. You saw my chart, Corey, that we put up with the 7 or 8 different points. One of the big things is that not only do you have to look, in my opinion, at the action of the price in this bear flag, but the volume component is extremely important, because you want to see if this is actually occurring. Is a very high volume during the pull downside move, and you want to see a layoff of volume where you see the consolidation moving on the flag part. And then to confirm that breakdown is a further increase in volume, much greater than the average, because then you realize what's going on.
That's exactly right. Edwards and McGee and Thomas Bukowski, any analyst that's researched this pattern, shows that component. It's going deeper inside the pattern than just the price itself. On the way down, volume was quite high. It was distributed volume. On the rallies, the corrective move up, volume persistently decreased on the up rally. That's a bad thing for the bulls. And now we're seeing volume come back again on the selling. That's exactly correct in terms of confirming or taking it one step further in terms of the bear flag pattern.
Right, so I'll put a link on that. And if you're listening to this late Sunday night, I know we put this up Sunday night for a lot of people that can get it before the Monday. We're going to actually have that link, but it's going to be available on Monday morning very early, so that we can, you know, everybody else on Monday can get the bear patterns. And a link over to Corey's site. Corey has some, he probably forgot he wrote this, but back in 2008, he wrote some really good pieces on identifying a flag pattern, a bull and bear pattern. Just a educational piece. Corey, listen, when you were on last time, which I believe was the end of June, I want to tell you, you really nailed it in terms of your longer term. I think you probably expect it to happen a little bit faster, but the longer term thesis about the dollar will rise. And at that time, it was in a downward trend and there was kind of no hope for it. But you're like, listen, look at this pattern. Look at this level of oversold. Look at how we are, you know, getting to a point almost of a ridiculous selling pattern, and you know, too much on this side of the trade. And you said, you know, the dollar will begin to rise. And in the last, I think, month and a half or so now, we've seen approximately, I think, about a 7% rise in the dollar against, you know, on the Dixie, against the broad-based currency basket.
That's right. And the technical analysis gives us, what I like about it, it gives us levels to look for, and it gives us projections. It doesn't necessarily give us time. So sometimes that can be frustrating for traders if we have expectations that are not fulfilled within a day or a week, or in this case, a month. There were positive kickoff momentum patterns. It was history repeating in terms of the bottom zone at the 73 level.
Mm-hmm.
This has happened before. In the intermediate trend, and we look at the dollar on a larger term basis being down, but the actual intermediate trend is sideways.
Right.
And we were at the bottom of that channel. So the short-term trend, which is a six-month, maybe even as high as 1 year, has actually flipped 4 times since 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just simply looking at that. It's from a simple metric or stepping inside from more complex metrics. And so, correct, it took a little bit longer than we would have liked.
Right.
It took a little bit more consolidation, but the dollar has begun to rise, which has put pressure on stocks and commodities. We just saw recently gold and silver fell much, much larger than most people thought that could even happen.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, about a week before, a week and a half before, well, we started actually our silver rant again on the 8th and kept on really pressing on that through last week, and it actually happened. I will tell you that I am surprised how far that silver fell. I was surprised it didn't have very much support at all at that $32 level that was, well, it was a support level, but it was also a level of watch out below if it goes below this level. But
exactly.
the thing that what troubled me the most about silver sell-off was what it was saying, and that, you know, the dollar was one component. But, you know, if you looked at the big sell-off on Thursday during the day of last week of silver, and you look at what happened during the day on Thursday, And then you look at the night when it turned around, and silver was actually up about 2.5% in the after hours, late at night. And then all of a sudden, there was a comment from a European financial minister late in the night. I don't know what they're doing up, by the way, at this point. I mean, we're talking about probably their time, I don't know, 3 in the morning. And there was a comment out that they said that the Greece default is not out of the question anymore. And honestly, within 30 minutes, silver went from being 2.5% up to probably close to about 8 or 9% down in that period of time.
And so much is driven by headlines right now, it seems like.
Yeah, and but what the thing that bothers me the most about this, in terms of you know, thinking about what does this really translate to? You know, what does this mean? Why, if there's going to be a default, would gold and silver decline? Because, in fact, the thesis is that inflation and protection from sovereign debt defaults and protection from paper money types of defaults and devaluations – all should benefit gold and silver, right? That's the generic everyday thesis.
Sure. I think what happened in this case, it's a little bit of an intervening variable. I kind of think of gold as almost like a Goldilocks type, and silver for that matter too, in terms of a risk asset, like a Goldilocks component. For example, if things are okay, silver or gold can rise with stocks, and just general inflation trends push these things higher in a good market. In a terrible market, one that everything is collapsing, which is the worst-case scenario, which happened late 2008 into early 2009,
mm-hmm.
People sold gold, sold the commodities, really these safe havens, so to speak, because they were profitable. So they were losing money on their account than everything else, oil, stocks, etc. And so they really just trimmed whatever they had left that worked, and that was gold. So it's possible we're seeing that kind of repeat, where everything is falling so rapidly that portfolios that individual investors are really taking, they're selling the profits on what works, mm-hmm. what has been working, and that's gold. So that's a worst-case scenario is actually bearish for gold. Gold, I think, would benefit from a stable decline or a not panicked or not, which that never really happens, but decline in the economy, but not one that tips so quickly where the only thing working is gold, therefore the only place people can raise money from is their profitable gold positions.
I think that is a good point, and I think that's a very concerning factor. I mentioned this earlier, that the amount of movement of gold recently is very much a sign of a liquidity grab, where they're looking for, you know, anything that they can get their hands on to give them liquidity, because they don't want to be invested in things that are you know, potentially going down, and this is a grab you could do very quickly. So, hey, Corey, what are you working on anything for next week at all that we can kind of like point some people over to, or what you have anything in mind that you're going to be working on the blog?
I'm catching you off guard here.
I'm sorry.
What I want to do is document that at the Afraid to Trade blog, a lot of what I do is document pattern recognition or document it's teaching. So it's the principle of teach a man to fish and he'll be able to eat for his lifetime versus give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day. So what I'd like to do is document large-scale events or the patterns that are going on and make it for an educational resource. And so what I plan to do for the next week is start a series called Lessons from the Fall, speaking about what happened with gold, silver, stocks, what went into this in terms of the volume. And not hindsight, obviously, but just look at what happened. So in the future, when you see these type of things, for example, distributive volume, momentum divergences, overhead resistance in terms of gold, overextended price, etc. I'm going to document these things in a series and just called Lessons from the Fall, with the goal being this is what happened, learn from this, and next time you see these type of things, be careful. You can expect this to happen again. So
right.
I think that's well, a lot of what I do with the blog is educational for the future.
The other thing I'll mention and then we'll let you go is that I would wonder if you want to think about, remember last month I came up with this basic idea. I mean, I've said it 100 times before, but I talked to you specifically about this idea that, hey, you know, it looks like there could be a real interesting move when we see that there's an option expiration. We see this real downside move. And every time we saw that this year, there's been a quick 1 or 2 week up move after that. Remember that? And this, the exact opposite happened when we saw this big up move into options expiration to get over that $1,200 point on the S&P, and then it dropped like a rock. And the other pattern that we see regularly is the end of the quarter, the movement of markets up into the quarter on a performance chase, on a rebalancing, on a in a situation where you see especially this kind of drawdown of stocks and the movement of bonds on the upside. there's going to be a rebalance happening. And the question is there any pattern that we can play over, let's say, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of next week that's going to be interesting so that maybe there's a quick, very quick, you know, short-term trade that could be put on and then taken off?
Sure. In terms of the, you know, we're talking about the flag, about this this the podcast here. But in the larger picture, yes, the flag is one component, but the other picture is lots and lots of support areas, moving averages, confluence, Fibonacci's, on all these indexes where we are now. So 1,100 on the S&P, I focus most of my analysis on that.
Mm-hmm.
We very well could hit a bounce.
Right.
And if we look at the pattern from, I think it was June or July 2009, that was similar in terms of the head and shoulders. Even Jim Cramer mentioned that on TV about the head and shoulders. It was a very widely followed pattern.
Mm-hmm.
It triggered in terms of classical analysis and then failed. So this could very well happen. And a lot of times when a market makes a very obvious pattern, but the pattern fails, a bigger move comes in the opposite direction.
Right.
Meaning those that got short on the actual signal that triggered last week are going to be forced out. And it's just a feedback loop in the opposite direction. So,
well, the good news is that CNBC is probably not going to play the whole bear flag thing. You know, they're big on the head and shoulders, and that's pretty much where they stop in their technical analysis. So we're not going to get that widespread knowledge of the bear flag, probably from the media. So we'll see.
Yeah, but if we do see a movement up, now just keep in mind, the flag is one pattern, but otherwise there are confluence of four areas that have worked in the past, in the last month. They really did hold the market up, and they were there before the market fell, which is your S&P, and really all of them, the triple Fibonacci confluence, mm-hmm. the double confluences. So if they do hold, it will invalidate the bear flag pattern, but
right.
if not, the lower levels, if these things fail, the lower levels are, again, the pattern projection and two more levels of Fibonacci confluence at the 2010 lows in all the indexes, which
mm-hmm.
is about 1020, 1040 in the S&P. So
yep.
either play up off of that on real time or break down to those confluence levels at 1020, 1040. And so on.
Yeah, I hear you. Corey Rosenblum, Afraid to Trade. He has some great information out there that you could learn from over at afraidtotrade.com. And also, he has a great book out that you can grab. Just search his name. Come to my site. We'll put links on that. And if you want to learn anything about technical analysis, if you think there's some voodoo in it, there's no voodoo. It's just really a recognition of action of price and of behavioral finance, really, in the end. So check that out. And Corey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Andrew.
All right. Bye-bye. And as they say in show business, that's a wrap. Probably a few more things we could talk about. On the blog this week, we have some commentary by Art Cashin and what he looks at as the eye of the storm. We also have coming up European numbers. You need to look at the risk factors here because when you look at the LIBOR rates and you look at the OIS numbers and you look at all the different CDS numbers, you're going to probably come to the same conclusion that we have come to. In addition, we are also writing about some the bear flag that we mentioned before. We're going to continue writing for the next week. That's it, where we're going to put on the private blog / client only commentary from the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy and Horowitz & Company Global Allocations. We're going to put that on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll mention, please do me a favor, go and nominate us for the podcast awards. All the information is on the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And finally, please do me a favor, if you haven't done so already, Twitter. You get this stuff first and hot off the press. At Andrew Horowitz, one big word, and you know, Andrew Horowitz. Just sign up and follow me on Twitter, and you'll get all of this information, all of our blog posts, all of our podcasts, all of the things that we're talking about, faster than you could say Twitter, actually. Guy Adami, Larry Williams, and Frank Curzio are up on the show coming up. And we have a few more surprises in store, I'm sure. And from there, we're going to say, have a great week. You know, watch for a Thursday rise with low volume. I will tell you that that is a very high probability, at least the low volume part of it. There's some holidays in there that you have to watch for. And from there, you know, watch for that rebalancing towards the end of the month. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Thanks for joining me.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.